Hello, I'm Neil Allen from Hudson, New York. You're listening to WGXE ACRA 90.7 FM.
Who is community radio for?
It's for people.
You mean it's for the people?
What's the difference between people and the people?
People you see on the street are people. You can see them. You can't see the people. There's too many to see.
You can't see anything on the radio anyway.
That's what's great about radio. There's nothing to see.
That means you can drive at the same time you listen to the radio.
Do you think it's safe to operate a motor vehicle while listening to WGXC?
Is it safe to use power tools while listening to WGXC?
90.7 FM. WGXC.
El Movimiento Sanctuario del Condado de Colombia es una organización basada en el Condado de Colombia que organiza junto a inmigrantes y aliados para apoyar, empoderar y defender colectivamente a nuestras comunidades. CCSM ofrece programas que ayudan a personas recién llegadas, incluyendo programas de alimentos, fondos de ayuda mutua, servicios de apoyo legal y oportunidades para ser un organizador y activista. Puedes encontrar más información en las redes sociales a CCSMNY o llamando al 518-303-3848.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Becca Van Kay of Pearling, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
White House. Ooh, what a fade out. Very nice.
I know you like fade outs.
Good evening and happy one day belated Labor Day from the Capital District Democratic Socialist Good Time Hour. You're listening to us on WGXC 90.7 ACRA on your FM dial. We broadcast at 7 p.m. on the first Tuesday of every month, and tonight we're live from the WGXC studio on Main Street in Catskill. So if you want to walk on by, we'll give you a shout out. I'm one of your hosts, Casey, here with Poche Noir, my co-host, who in his less pretentious identity goes by Bill.
Bonsoir, comrades. Tonight being September 2nd of 2025, it's the 16th day of the month of Fructidor in the year 233 of the French Republican calendar. And this particular day is represented by Le Citron, which is actually the lemon in French.
Sure. On tonight's show, we have special guests Mary Liz and Paul Stewart, who run the Underground Railroad Education Center at 194 Livingston Avenue in Albany. As usual, here's our customary disclaimer. Remarks made tonight reflect the opinions of whomever may be speaking them and not of WGXC. Also, these remarks need not reflect the opinions of anyone else in the Democratic Socialists of America. It's just myself, Poche Noir, and now Mary Liz and Paul.
And if you disagree or you want to qualify anything said on the show tonight, then you might consider joining the Democratic Socialists of America and making your thoughts known. There is no line to be towed by members of the DSA. We all do what we have to do to achieve a fairer society, but the question is how practically to get there, and there are many differing opinions as to that. To be a DSA member, you do not have to be a strict Marxist like me. All you need to do is go to dsausa.org or to Capital District DSA, that's all one word, .org.
Yeah. We're going to dive into one more song. I'm really excited about our conversation tonight. We're really excited to have you both here. Before we do that, because I think it'll be a hefty one, let's listen to another song. What are you playing for us?
This is going to be Rhiannon Giddens off of one of her most recent albums.
Thank you. day I work the line. Every minute overtime. Fingers nimble, fingers quick. My fingers bleed to make you rich. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. Take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. Shall I keep it?
Okay. That was At the Purchaser's Option by Rhiannon Giddens. That was inspired by her seeing an antebellum advert that sought to sell a 22-year-old woman as a slave, where her child of 9 months old was to be part of that sale at the purchaser's option.
Bleak. And with that, with us in the studio tonight are Mary Liz and Paul Stewart, as we said, the founders of the Underground Railroad Education Center in Albany. Welcome to the show, Mary Liz and Paul.
Hello.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about Albany's Underground Railroad Education Center.
Okay. Well, I think for it to make sense, it probably is wise to step back in time a bit to the late 1990s. I was teaching in a fifth grade classroom, and I had some very tangible 10-year-old thinkers who were quite convinced the Underground Railroad had to do with subways and above-ground trains. So I thought if I could bring into my classroom for these cherubs accounts of real live activists, Underground Railroad activists from the community, then it might help them better understand this period in American history. So that is what motivated me to start what was supposed to be just a personal research project.
And as for myself, I was working in social services in the community, but writing on the side for a community paper, an African-American inner-city paper, and writing stories about local history, and wanted to really get into any stories that had to do with local history about African-Americans in Albany. And so it seemed like our two interests overlapped in this subject, so we decided to make it a personal research project.
I'd say so.
Yeah.
Paul, what was the paper that you were working on? Is it still around?
There was a newspaper. It was called the Scene newspaper at the time. It's not around anymore, but it was it grew out of the work of particularly Alice Green and some other people at a place called Trinity Institution back in those days. This is probably the early 80s. And then after Alice Green had been the editor of the paper, then Art Mitchell took it over. And Art Mitchell had been a radio DJ, a black radio DJ in the Capital District. And so he managed the paper. And it was about that time that I came on involved with the paper. And so we started doing stories about local black history. And I like to find stories that other people hadn't been thinking about. And so this Underground Railroad seemed like a good one as well.
So it initially started for students.
Yes.
That's so.
At least for me, it was student focused. For Paul, it was community focused through the newspaper.
Yeah.
And we thought a year and a half, we would, conduct the research that would open up to us information about real people with real stories, and life would go on. Capital Region, 19 plus academic institutions, everybody's heard at least the phrase Underground Railroad, if nothing more. So we really thought this was going to be a piece of cake. However, we realized very soon into our personal research project that that was not to be the case. And so we decided to read scholarly sources. We thought at least we would have documented, researched information about activists that we could then share publicly with our respective audiences. Well, as we dove into these scholarly sources, as you know, they very nicely have footnotes and bibliographic references. And as we were reading through these scholarly sources, lo and behold, there's a little reference to this guy called Stephen Myers, who was a black abolitionist in Albany, and then Lydia and Abigail Mott, two white Quaker sisters also living and working in Albany, involved in the Underground Railroad. And of course, you know, the scholarly sources with their footnotes and bibliographic references gave us the point of origin that we could pursue to research further and understand more about these people being referenced. The problem was we could not visit these repositories all over the country where these resources were located. So we went to our local Albany public librarians, to whom I always feel dedicated to give a shout out, because they were because without their willingness to use their resources to bring resources into us, we would not be where we are today. And for those who have enough gray hair, who remember microfilm machines, yeah, that's, we had lots of dates with the microfilm machines. Mm-hmm. But as we were going through these preserved period documents, voices and stories of people were emerging that to that date had no place in this Underground Railroad story. Their accounts of Underground Railroad activism were dramatically different than the standard retelling that gets marshaled out to many of us, especially in school settings, at which point Paul and I looked at each other and said, this is bigger than our respective audiences. And so at that point, we decided that we needed to find ways to share this inspiring and empowering information with the local community.
One of the things that for us is that we were thinking about this idea of where do people live, where do people work, where do they conduct their activities, and also our core interest, our core questions were different, I think, than what people usually ask. And one of the core questions we had was, you know, who are the African Americans who were involved in the Underground Railroad work in Albany, and you know, like I said, where do they live? Where do they work? Where do they conduct their activities? And that actually gives you a different pitch of the story than the way people usually tell the story, you know, so that instead of talking about, you know, we would prefer to talk about, you know, a woman, I'm trying to remember her name right now, but say, Catherine Rice, we'll call her Catherine, I think her last name was Rice, who found a place to live on Grand Street in Albany and wrote William Still a letter from Grand Street to say thank you for the help that had been provided to her, that's the place where we begin the story rather than Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, right? Mm-hmm. So very much this wanting to be local first and then also to tell the story of the people who were that the Underground Railroad story is really built around, the passengers of the Underground Railroad, not the abolitionists and the saviors, if you will. And of course, you know, as we went through this and finding local people and local stories, of course, we did settle on Stephen and Harriet Myers in particular, who were central to the story in the Capital Region in Albany. But also other people like Thomas Elkins and William Henry Johnson and, you know, numerous other individuals who were also important to the story. And so as we encountered the story, it began to look different to us than the way people usually tell it to us.
And who were the Myers? I'm sure you could clue our listening audiences to who the Myers were.
Yeah. Stephen and Harriet Myers, and maybe if I could just say one other thing in addition Paul was saying, is that for us the focus has been on reclaiming the voices and stories of both black abolitionists and freedom seekers. They have been central to our research and central to the way that we interpret this history.
Yeah, it's something that, like, I grew up in the Capital Region, had my whole education here, learned about the Underground Railroad through Nature's Classroom. I don't know if your school did that in fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And it really didn't dawn on me how the education specifically of, like liberating the slaves on the Underground Railroad, you hear about Harriet Tubman, you hear about Frederick Douglass. It was so white-centered beyond those two. So it is, like, those are the untold stories that you're outlining.
The other thing I find about the focus on Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass is that it allows for an element or a degree of inclusion. You know, black voices, black experiences, people both who were enslaved, claiming their freedom and becoming activists on behalf of others. But when that's all we hear about, it's as if, well, the story's done now. A man, a woman, both of whom are black, we've got this covered, now we can move on. And what it has done, in my mind, is dramatically reduce the impact of this period in American history and has essentially, not, I wouldn't say eliminated it, but minimized it in terms of its the real place of Underground Railroad activity in the American narrative.
Like, almost tokenized them.
Yes,
like they
that's
are
a good,
portrayed as, like, very clean cut, like almost like white in white history books.
Very much so.
And also to, you know, where they were. You know, I mean, I think that there's a tendency to, what's the word I'm looking for here, but kind of mythicize, you know, the role that these characters played, so much so that you forget that the story that we're talking about is a story that played out on Lumber Street or Livingston Avenue today in Albany, or on Pearl Street in Albany, as well as, you know, lots of other streets, you know, no doubt even here, Main Street in Catskill, you know.
100%.
You know, but it's these are things that played out in places close to you, you know. I like to, when we talk about this from where we are at 194 Livingston Avenue, you know, I like to say to people, you know, well, Stephen and Harriet Myers lived there, but then they also lived at 10 Lark Street, which was just a block up, half a block up the street, or at 3rd Street, which is just another, it's a block away, you know, and Lydia and Abigail Mott, who were two white Quaker women who were active in the community, lived on Columbia Street, you know, right just a couple blocks away, you know, and others. And these are people that are mentioned in abolitionist newspapers, that are mentioned in the regular press as being responsible for doing these things. You know, so it's not like it's lost history to the extent that we don't bother to look for it. You know, we can find their stories, we can tell their stories, and they can be told in terms of these are things that happen locally, you know.
I would also add that one of the issues I've identified with the iconicization, if you will, of Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass is that they are heroes on a pedestal, which to me makes them untouchable. I'm no hero. I'm just a regular local person and doing what I think needs to be done. And so what I see happening is very much what happens with Black History Month, you know, the hero, so I don't want to call it worship, but it's that notion of all these great people, aren't they doing great and wonderful things? And it's usually the same group of people rolled out on a regular basis. And somehow all of us are to aspire to the great things they do, but I don't feel like a great person. You know, I'm just trying to bumble through every day. And so what we have tried to do with the stories of Stephen and Harriet Myers and their colleagues, William Topp, Dr. Thomas Elkins, Sarah Johnson, and so on, is to raise them up not as heroes, but as local folks like the rest of us, dedicating their lives to justice for all people. And they have done that at great, they have done, you know, engaged in various activities at great risk to themselves and to those with whom they interact. But yet they continue day after day after day. And what we hope people understand when they interact with us is if they did it as regular folks, so can I.
Fair to say it's the democratization of the history of the Underground Railroad?
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair. Mm-hmm. I think you'd ask earlier about, you know, there's probably like 50 million different things that directions we can talk about here, but you ask about whether or not we were going into schools, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And we do have occasion to go into schools, although we don't get that many requests. I'm not sure how to balance, you know, whether that's a good thing or not. But I do know that we also have students that come to us for different school trips and things like that. Again, we probably could have a lot more of that. But we also like to reach out to adults because they're the people that are voting today, and they're the people that are dealing with, you know, the disintegration of the communities now. And a lot, so much of what is happening are things that we need to wrestle with and struggle with now, you know, not in the future when the fifth graders get to be, you know, but we, because a lot of this stuff will be lost by then. So we need to deal with it now.
Well,
so
it's a very active process of trying to, rewrite history.
Yeah. Yeah. to call back, call history back, yeah. To make a corrective to some of the erroneous things that have been really kind of pushed on us over the years in terms of history. So
it is, I think it's really cool how you're focused on like the people who lived on the blocks that we live now, because again, growing up here, I knew about it 100% via like my teacher. Mr. Thorman was a great teacher. Shout out to him. But until I moved back here as an adult, did I know that there were like plantations in Coxsackie, mm-hmm. and things that like there was so much slavery up here, and then so much activity that we just aren't taught. And I think it brings it home in a real way. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how many people think that New York State didn't have slavery in 1776.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And it's, I mean, slavery was outlawed in what, 1815, 1819?
Right. So 1827 was when it was finally ended in New York State. But, you know, what's funny about that, if you will, is that there's a great deal to which we live in a world where of misdirected attention. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, we know that, you know, General Schuyler had servants. They were actually slaves. You know, or even General Washington had enslaved people, you know, working for him. But
all of them,
we find, we find that they either invent different names for them, fail to mention them, or, you know, just downplay them in such a way that it looks like they're not there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like, that's a very sad representation of what the story is.
In an effort to counter what Paul was just describing, something we have been very committed to from the beginning is to do our best to find names and stories of people who had been enslaved and that had, you know, a relationship to our local area. And for us, that becomes an incredibly important piece to recalling this history and helping us really understand it, in that the people who were enslaved are the center part of the story. And so often they are overlooked. They're nameless, they're faceless, they're runaways, they're fugitives, all of which has a whole lot of baggage to it. And our contention is these are people with names, with stories, with families, with some heavy, heavy duty decisions to make about self-emancipation. And these are folks who, without the work that they were forced to do, New York State wouldn't be what it is. The country wouldn't be what it is. And so it becomes, again, for us, a way to really, I would say, you know, to push back against the narratives that elevate one group of people over another and you know, sort of strata, one strata over another.
Yeah, so this is all our the basis of what we do, but of course, you know, we started off as a kind of a personal research project. We thought we came to the point where we said that this is bigger than our respective audiences, and we started looking for a way to share this with the community. We started doing walking tours early on. We did that for about a year, just put some pictures in a binder and walked to the places where people lived or worked or conducted their activities. We did three or four of those, three of them. We did three the first year, mm-hmm. and at the end of the year we said we wanted to go to a conference that was close and expensive that dealt with this subject, where we could meet other people that were interested in this. We looked around and didn't see one that was immediately convenient, so we decided to organize one. And we thought that we'd get 30 or 40 people. We got 130 people. Wow. People were really excited about it. We made the mistake of asking people if they wanted to do it again. Of course, everybody said yes. And it sort of fell to us to kind of make that happen. The conference moved from that church to the College of St. Rose and functioned at St. Rose for a number of years. And then shortly after we had gotten off the ground with this conference program, As we continued to do the research, we found that this building at 194 Livingston Avenue was still standing, that had a tie-in to this story, that it was the place that had been the headquarters of the Vigilance Committee of the Underground Railroad, and it also had been the home of Stephen and Harriet Myers. And so we approached the owner. We said, "Can we help you fix it up?" And then, very much to our surprise, he said, "I'd give it to you, except there are liens against the building."
Oh, no.
And that, so we figured, well, okay, if he's willing to give it to us and there are liens, the easy way for him to do this, because we didn't want to take the liens on, would be for him to let the county foreclose on him, and then we would purchase the mm-hmm. building from the county. Then he'd been out from under the liens, and we could still have access mm-hmm. to get the building. And, of course, not us personally, but our not-for-profit organization.
So you went to an auction?
So we approached the county directly and said, "Can we buy this building?" And, of course, they were all too willing to sell us this dilapidated building that was falling apart, you know, for a song, basically. So we paid $1,500 for the building. And
wow.
We have invested, like, $1.3 million in it thus far. And
I think it would be fair to draw at least a verbal picture of this building.
Mm-hmm,
it is a 10-room Greek Revival architectural building, so three stories above ground, one below ground. When we arrived at the house, the bearing wall, which is in the basement and perpendicular to the back wall of the building, the bearing wall and the back wall are designed to hold the building up. Well, the bearing wall in the basement was leaning incredibly, so it was not doing its job. The back wall of the building had a significant number of bricks that had fallen out, lintels, under the base of the windows had fallen out, chimneys had, so the back wall and the bearing wall were not working together to support this building, but it was still standing. The chimneys, there were two chimneys, front roof and back roof. They had deteriorated. One fell into the basement. The other one fell in the backyard.
So you had your work cut out for you.
Yeah. And the list goes on. But the thing that I always like to share about this is that Paul and I knew absolutely nothing about building preservation, mm-hmm. restoration, nothing, not at all. But this building had a story. And made us stand in the front hallway of that building, recognizing where we stood. Stephen Myers stood there. Harriet Myers stood there. Thomas Elkins stood there. Freedom Seekers walked the same space that we were standing in. And we had to save this building. And so forward we went and listed, you know, the services of all sorts of people, volunteers, preservationists, historians, professionals that we needed to, you know, whose services we needed to enlist, and to all contributing, you know, folks in the neighborhood, all contributing to both reclaiming the land on which the house stands, but also reclaiming this house so that it can be open for public engagement with the history, with the story, but also with a whole host of other opportunities to engage with the history. And I say that because coming out of the classroom setting for me meant that I brought with me my theories of education. And one of the very important theories to me was the Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences. And taking that theory, it was very applicable in my classroom setting. And I carried it with me into the work we were doing.
I'm sorry, I'm unfamiliar with that.
Oh, Howard Gardner's theory, the thumbnail sketch of this theory of multiple intelligences is that each of us carries within it eight intelligences. And these intelligences, though, we carry within us in different degrees. And so for someone who is drawn to music and interacts with the world through music, perhaps thinks a lot in musical form, that's someone who has a strong musical intelligence. Now, that's clearly not me. But others, an example I'd like to give
some
is
try.
There's the one example that I can like to offer many times is that there is an environmental intelligence that Howard Gardner has identified. And for folks who have a very strong environmental intelligence, they interact with the world through environmental issues, through gardening, through places, what can I say, you know, like wild places or untamed environmental places. So these are people like the master gardeners who have stepped up to the plate at the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence, and they don't want to listen to a lecture. They don't want to come to a house tour. They don't want to come to a conference, but they will spend hours working in the gardens that have been created around the Myers residence, planting and tending to plants, food and flowering plants that reflect what was growing when Stephen and Harriet lived in the Myers residence. So that is their manner of interacting, engaging with this history. And so as the Underground Railroad Education Center has moved forward over time, we continue to apply this theory of multiple intelligences, looking for different ways that we can offer opportunities for folks to engage with this very empowering story in a way that is meaningful for them. So that has influenced a whole variety of developments, organizational developments over time.
I want to call back to your comment about how you often teach adults this history that is largely untold, and how it connects to now. I think, I mean, we're all kind of seeing a lot play out with ICE and with all of these undocumented people or documented people like being rounded up and deported, and it calls back to me a lot of people who were, you know, like hunting down slaves. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm curious about your take on that and how the history that you're teaching can tie into the now.
Sure. It looks and feels like the fugitive slave law. I mean, that's, and many people who come to us, and as we tell the stories about the Underground Railroad and people escaping from enslavement and being hunted by, bounty hunters, people recognize that almost right away that what's happening with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is very similar, if not the same, as what people were experiencing in the 19th century. You know, the kind of terror, if you will, that people experience, recognizing these folks coming into communities and roughing people up and kidnapping people, basically. So people see that right away, and it's something that's very present to people. So as people learn about and hear about the story of the Underground Railroad, the parallels are very obvious to folks. And so that is something that we talk about in the course of our sessions with people. One of the things we do a lot is invite people to come to the Myers residence, sit in the front parlor, in the space where we can point to some documents from the past that describe how the Vigilance Committee of the Underground Railroad acted and worked in that setting in the 1850s, and show people how they're in the place where that history happened, and then walk them through the house. And as we walk through the house to the different parts of the house, we talk to people about different things, like, for instance, the work that many of the women were doing back in those days in terms of supporting the broader abolitionist work by doing knitting circles and sewing circles and, doing other kinds of things to raise money for the abolitionist newspapers and for the needs of the freedom seekers, and show how, you know, and it's at that point that people often see very clearly. They say, well, this is part of what's going on today. And I think about, the broad movement really across the country of resistance to the things that Immigration and Customs Enforcement are doing, and that's the same kind of energy and agency that people possessed in relation to the story of the Underground Railroad. So we walk people through the house. We try to show them some of the different things that we're involved with in terms of archaeology, in terms of the women's stories, in terms of our library and personal stories about individuals who are freedom seekers. And those are some of the things that we do in terms of sharing that story with people.
The other thing I'd like to add is that unbeknownst to us when we started our research back in the late 1990s, but very quickly learned and were very pleased to learn, was that our black abolitionists were involved in a variety of justice responses. So yes, they were making themselves available to assist freedom seekers who would be coming into town and looking for assistance. And not every freedom seeker did, but for those who did, our abolitionists would be available to attend to those needs. But additionally, our black abolitionists also were involved in justice-related issues regarding jobs, housing, mm-hmm. health, education, voting rights. I mean, you know, they're just to draw on Stephen Meyer's story, for instance, because we know his the best. By the way, just a quick little side note, Stephen Myers himself was born enslaved in Rensselaer County. We say around 1800 because we've yet to see a birth certificate, and researched documentation gives various birth dates. So somewhere around 1800. He was born enslaved. He was manumitted or given his legal freedom by the family that claimed ownership of him in 1818, at which point he moves on into adulthood, into a state heavily invested in the institution of slavery. As he makes his way in this world, he meets Harriet Myers, who had been born free. Her family, her father and brother in particular, we know, owned and managed sloops on the Hudson River between New York City and Albany. And so they were small businessmen, certainly, dealing with contracts and so on, business negotiations and whatnot. Nonetheless, Harriet and Stephen marry in May of 1827. New York State is still a state supporting and sanctioning the institution of slavery. As I say, you know, we know their story more in detail than some of their colleagues. But with the point that I'm long-windedly getting to is that for someone like Stephen Myers, he was the president of the New York State Suffrage Association, which was working on the effort to change legislation in New York State to allow black men to vote. He was a member of the New York or the American Council of Colored Laborers, which we often equate to unions of today and the kinds of issues they work for.
A question.
Yes.
So let's say that I am a manumitted slave
mm-hmm.
in the year 1820, I can't vote?
Correct. If, yep.
I answered.
Yeah. the other thing, just a couple of other examples, and have to do with education. The city of Albany had the Albany Public Schools in this time period, and Stephen and Harriet Myers had four children, and a number of their colleagues had children, all of whom were very dedicated to the value of education, and black families were finding that their children were not being allowed to enter the public school. So the black families pooled their resources, mm-hmm. established schools for their children to ensure that they were receiving an education. Finally, Stephen Myers gets to a point where it's like, enough is enough. So he sues the city school district of Albany. And when Paul and I first read, he won his case in 1851. We were so thrilled, only to read further to find out that the courts allowed his four children to enter the Albany public schools, but no other black children were allowed. So colleagues and other community members pursued this issue in the courts for another 20 years. And it wasn't until 1871 that Albany City Schools opened their doors to all children. 1871.
Wow. Yeah. Well after the Civil War ended. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was going to, what was I going to say?
I don't know.
Well, you know, we've been restoring the Stephen and Harriet Myers historic site. We've, as I mentioned, you know, we purchased the building. Our group purchased the building for $1,500, and we've put $1.3 million into it. But we've kind of felt, in terms of the work that we're doing, that we were outgrowing that space. So we sit down with an architect and figure out, you know, another building, and we have lots that were part of our project that we over the years had purchased that were a little bit east of where the building is. And we decided we were going to build on those lots and put this new building there. So the building that we're looking to build is a 14,000 square foot facility that one of its features is that we have purchased a barn timber frame out of Montgomery County, where this timber frame had sat for, 1760s? And where some enslaved people had worked in this barn. And so we purchased the barn, the timber frame, the framework of the barn is really what we purchased. And we're going to use that as the core of the main assembly hall of this new facility. Mm-hmm. We're going to have some offices in the building. We're going to have some archaeology workspace in the building. We're going to have some storage. We're going to have some place where we can store clothing and costumes. We're going to have a place where we're going to have a library. Our library is going to move in there. We've got the larger space there is a large exhibition space that's also multi-use space. We can do a lot of different things in there. We're going to have a commercial kitchen. The place is going to use geothermal heating and cooling, and 70% of the light inside is going to come from exterior sources. Mm-hmm. And the building itself is going to be made from thermally treated from a sustainable wood from a sustainable forest. It's low carbon. And the barn timber frame, all of the carbon has kind of worked out of that. We're going to have a very environmentally friendly, we're trying to satisfy what's called a Living Building Challenge certification, which is an environmental certification for buildings. And we're using, instead of steel, we're going to be using cross-laminated timbers in the building. Wow. So there's a lot of good environmental features.
Oh, but there's more. The thing I just to mention about this, it's a Dutch barn timber frame that Paul was referencing. It did come from a farm. It was from the 1760s. And as Paul mentioned, there were people enslaved who worked on this farm. So for us, taking this timber frame and having it reassembled in the main assembly hall of the Interpretive Center, as we're calling it now, will allow us to tangibly talk about the institution of slavery in New York State, but also tangibly talk about concepts of democracy and liberty in this very same space. And that's very important to us because without the Myers residents, as an organization, we were established, what, 3 years or so, two years before we had the Myers residents. So we were, you know, we were functioning without a tangible artifact from this period. We would, you know, take our talks out to the community and do the walking tours and all this and that, but we still didn't have that tangible artifact. And when we were able organizationally to purchase what is today the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence, and we ended up with something that, as a tangible artifact, brought the story to life in ways that we had previously not been able to do. And so having this Dutch barn timber frame in this prominent position within this building, it will be the same kind of thing, a tangible artifact. But it's also, what I just would like to say very quickly, just as an example, this building is not just about Underground Railroad Education Center, because the building itself is located, as is the Myers residence, in a food desert. So this building, this new building, mm-hmm. will give the opportunity to host farmers markets on a regular wow. basis, to host workshops that can provide folks with information about green jobs that are available, how to get into that world, and so on, and a whole host of other things. The commercial kitchen that Paul referenced will be able to be utilized by entrepreneurs who are trying to get their own culinary or baking business off the ground, but need a commercial space in which to do that. So this is how we're thinking about this building. So,
have you checked the timber frame for inscriptions from its builders?
Say again, have we?
Sometimes in those days, people put inscriptions on the frames, sometimes prayers, sometimes signatures, sometimes dates.
We haven't seen that on the timber frame that we're using. What we have seen, of course, is the coating that the kind of old-timey timber frame constructors use, the coating that signals how to put the thing together. We haven't seen those other things.
Pre-industrial IKEA. Yeah.
So if Bill and I wanted to come up and see this project unfold, where is that going to be located, or how could we support it? As just me and Bill.
Yeah. Well, we're at 194 Livingston Avenue, and that's where the Myers residence is. This other building that we're going to be building is at 184 to 190 Livingston Avenue. So it's just a short way down the street.
Yeah, and what neighborhood of Albany are
that's
we in?
That's the Arbor Hill neighborhood. Okay, of Albany. And we'd love to have you come. We'd love to all the people who are hearing
that
us
terrific.
In the sound of my voice. We would love to have you come, but we would really love to have you call us ahead of time at 518-621-7793 to schedule a time mm-hmm. so that we could actually spend the time with you and talk about the building and its story and the people who were part of it.
And if I may, too, certainly would like to encourage folks to visit the Underground Railroad Education Center website. Lots of information available on there. We try very hard to keep it updated so it becomes a vehicle for communication. And certainly we are also on social media, various platforms, you know, again, to try and find various ways to stay in touch and connected with folks in the community.
Yeah. Do you know the Albany Social Justice Center?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. The DSA works with Food Not Bombs mm-hmm. on Saturdays for the okay. free store there. Mm-hmm. It could be a cool opportunity.
Yeah. I will say too, over the years, as Underground Railroad Education Center has matured, we have arrived at a point where we are more able to collaborate with others, and it has just been an incredible, incredible journey. And it's always for us, and I will say even for other Underground Railroad documented sites in New York State, for all of us, it's always been about putting the story front and center, the voices of those who have been eliminated from this history and its retelling. You know, our purposes have always been focused on the story of the people and their courage and their fortitude, and it's not that way in every state. So in that sense, it's been good to be here in this state.
So we have 5 minutes left, and I am curious, what happened to Stephen Harriet Myers? Are there children? I mean, so they had four kids. Like, well, with any of the the people that you're researching, are there still their descendants living in Albany? Do we know any of them?
So Stephen and Harriet Myers, well, as Mary Liz mentioned, Stephen born around 1800, Harriet born around 1804, and they got married in 1827. They had four or five children. One died early. The other four grew to adulthood. They moved when Stephen died in 1870. Harriet died in 1865. The children lived in Albany for a while, but then I think they moved to Philadelphia, and then later on, different people moved different places. You know, one of the stories that we do know is that I'm trying to remember, is it Catherine or Harriet who married, it was Elizabeth who married Stanislaus Kostka-Gavern, and he was actually a labor activist, then somehow the family kind of wound up all over the country. Mm-hmm. A couple of them in New York City, somebody in Minnesota, somebody in the West Coast. There was one in New England who eventually wound up also on the West Coast. So some of the families are, the people are still around, though not necessarily in Albany.
Right.
Yeah. And actually there are two sisters, one in Minneapolis and one in Queens, who have reached out to us and with whom we stay in fairly regular contact. So right, I think they're fourth generation. Yeah. So it's again another opportunity to touch history and, you know.
Yeah. Well, how cool.
That is cool.
And a shout out to Summer Wilbur and Shelley Hegan for connecting us.
Yeah.
Really, really special. Do you work with Planned Parenthood in Albany, doing any sort of awareness?
We haven't there. No, we haven't there.
Offhand, I can see that an Underground Railroad for people who look for abortion.
Absolutely.
Abortion treatment.
Absolutely. Yeah. So. A lot of...
Fortunately, a place we're at, but...
Yeah.
Thank God we have people who know the history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah.
Well, with 2 minutes left, I guess we should do our little closing remarks. One more. Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for listening. That's all the time we have for this episode. Tune in next month, first Tuesday of the month, October 7th. It'll be our yearly spooky Halloween episode.
That's right. If you're interested in joining DSA, you may join at dsausa.org, where you'll certainly find a level of membership to comport with your finances, or you may find out more at Capital District DSA, all one word, .org.
We don't have time
for anything else. I don't know. Have we no time even for a little bit of an outro?
7:59.
Oh, that's it. I think we're all done.
You have 15 seconds.
Call us 518-621-7793.
Awesome. Thank you so much.